My name is Freddy Rokem, and I'm chairing but also participating in this panel exploring the public sphere. We have three speakers, Janelle Reinert, Annalisa Sacchi, and myself. And I will introduce each speaker before her appearance, and then I'll introduce myself. After each presentation, we'll have a short period of a few direct questions. And after the three speakers, we will open up the floor to more extensive comments, discussions about the subject that we are dealing with here. I think we felt an urgency, really strong urgency, to take up the subject of what is it actually that is happening within this broad concept of the public sphere. And I want to begin by introducing the first speaker, Janelle Reinert. She is a professor of theater and performance at the University of Warwick in the UK. She is former president of IFTR, the International Federation of Theater Research, and editor with Brian Singleton of the book series Studies in International Performance, published by Palgrave Macmillan. Her new book, which she's just finishing, is on the political theater of David Edgar, and it's going to be published by Cambridge University Press. So you already see what the subject is on the board, and I want to welcome Janelle, please.
Thank you, Freddie. So this project is a newly developing strand of my research, which attempts to re-examine theoretical concepts in an international context and asks how international alters their viability. How can some comparativist studies challenge our ways of thinking about key ideas in performance research and enrich our understanding of the global situation in which we live? I wanted to select and investigate an area which might be pertinent to our discipline across the board, no matter what place in the world to which we might turn, and thus the focus here on the concept of the public sphere. For performance scholars, the necessity of developing an international analysis of the concept of the public sphere seems clear because performance often claims to play an important role in such a sphere, especially in a context of globalization. However, the problems of understanding what the key components are and what constitutes the relationship between global, national, and local versions of the public sphere raise considerable challenges for my inquiry. An earlier version of this paper was written for the ongoing dialogue we at Warwick are having with Indian colleagues at JNU, Jawaharlal Nehru University in Delhi. Thus, the most developed aspects of my ideas come from Indian scholars. In the coming months, I hope to elaborate more fully in relation to the other parts of the world that I mention here. Of course, the very choice of topic already threw up considerable problems. One of the key research questions we formulated with our JNU colleagues has been stated as follows in our original partnership documents. How to engage comparatively East-West without ignoring on the one hand or reifying on the other the colonial, post-colonial histories of our nations. I became immediately aware that even the choice of concept, the public sphere, conjured up a European term clearly associated with a theorization of the rise of civic culture and bourgeois behavior during the Enlightenment period. This term came to scholarly prominence, as I'm sure you know, through the work of Jürgen Habermas, whose influential study, The Structural Transformation of the Public Sphere, an Inquiry into a Category of Bourgeois Society, appeared in German in 1962 and in English in 1969. If considered an historical study rather than a philosophical treatise, this book gives an account of new forms of communicative deliberation that emerged in England in the 1700s and on the European continent over the next century, with the French Revolution seen as the culmination of its emergence. But as a philosophical treatise, Habermas generalizes this Western European history into a universal theory of the public sphere, which performs the customary imposition of a European interpretation on a much larger and heterogeneous field. However, some Indian scholars also cite Habermas as a point of departure for their discussions, and the ramifications of global changes for the transformation of the Indian public sphere concern those scholars as much as they do someone like me, an American citizen living abroad. It should be acknowledged that Habermas himself, in the years since his first theorization, has significantly revised and reformulated his ideas to take account of more diverse histories and circumstances, developing a theory of communicative action as the basis for the kind of ethical discourse he would like to see constitute the public sphere. While I ultimately disagree even with Habermas's later theories, I have no wish to set him up as a straw man, but rather to build on and improve his ideas for use in our current historical conjuncture. So in this talk, I will outline what Habermas understood as the public sphere, critique the shortcomings of his theory, and offer some alternative theoretical models which might suit better an international contemporary perspective, ask about the relationship of theater and performance to that sphere, and finally comment on some current publics. So what is the public sphere? It is the leading term in a grouping of several cognates, the or a public as a noun, or as an adjective whose antonym is private, and of course the noun publicity. When Habermas wrote the public sphere about the public sphere as a concept, he intended to designate a zone of mediation between the state and individuals, where individuals could come together to engage in reasoned argument over key issues of mutual interest and concern, creating a space in which new ideas and the practice and discipline of rational public debate were cultivated. These sites were the new associational spaces, such as coffee houses, clubs, newspapers, theater, and the arts, and art criticism. In a section of his book called The Basic Blueprint, he writes, "The bourgeois public sphere may be conceived above all as the sphere of private people come together as a public. They soon claimed the public sphere regulated from above against the public authorities themselves, to engage them in a debate over the general rules governing relations in the basically privatized but publicly relevant sphere of commodity exchange and social labor. The medium of this political confrontation was peculiar and without historical precedent, people's public use of their reason," unquote. That strikes me as kind of vintage Habermas. In this view, Habermas sought to describe not only the historical reality of the post-absolutist societies of fledgling modernity, but also a trans-historical normative state of affairs. Thus, an emancipated public sphere was a goal that could only be achieved when social relations were organized according to the principle that the validity of every norm of political consequence be made dependent on a consensus arrived at in communication free from domination. This idea became the guiding thread of Habermas's vision of the public sphere, but it is also where the serious problems begin as well. Tracing a genealogy that led back to the Greek polis and the idea that citizens discussed topical issues in the agora, where they interacted as equals with equals, Habermas emphasized a continuity between the Greek and modern public spheres, as well as the differences arising from capitalism, the new economic system that came to triangulate the relations between the state, the economy, and the individuals trying to go public with their issues and desires. Based on this basic version of Habermas, I would make the following observations about access. Starting with Greek society based on slavery and a concept of citizenship that was far from inclusive, through to a similar exclusivity in the bourgeois public sphere of modernity, which in most cases did not include women or those with no property, the invocation of an idealized equality has not and does not now manifest in the composition of the historical Western public sphere. As political philosopher Nancy Fraser has written on this point, quote, "The relation between publicity and status is more complex than Habermas intimates, and declaring a deliberative arena to be a space where extant status distinctions are bracketed, a and neutralized is not sufficient to make it so, unquote. Two, those excluded from the official public sphere nevertheless have historically found their own spaces of discourse and intersubjective exchange in public, and have, through a variety of means, provided counterweight to the dominant public sphere. Therefore, the governing geometry of this sphere needs to be envisioned not as a unified field, but rather as a network or a rhizome with a plurality of entry points and indeed of publics. There is no monolithic sphere. Three, Habermas specified the content of the public sphere as the basically privatized but publicly relevant sphere of commodity exchange and social labor. This describes the moment of his focus in 17th and 18th century Europe, but it also covers over an historically differentiated struggle over the very terms private and public, what they mean, and the degree of opposition between them in any given period or context. Ideas of what constitutes appropriate topics for the public sphere need to be constantly interrogated and differentiated in light of the relations between the terms public and private in local, national, or global situations. And four, Habermas's emphasis on rational argument and consensus as the major mode of public sphere activity is uncomfortable from several points of view. It sets up certain communicative codes that are themselves exclusionary when class, gender, or caste expressions don't conform to the legitimated ways of contributing. He also idealizes the hoped-for outcome of public participation. Not always is consensus desired, but sometimes rather actual dissensus, the registration of a lack of consensus or insistence on polyvocal fragmentation, even disintegration of a univocal public voice. Habermas presumes that this discourse can lead to influence in decision-making at the point of consensus, and this too fails to characterize kinds of public discourse that may not be tied to political efficacy through recognized channels, or what are sometimes called weak publics because they don't have the power to take decisions that influence the state directly. In addition to these points, Habermas's initial theory suffers from a number of blind spots. There is a tendency to predicate the bourgeois public sphere on print culture. In the historical analysis of 18th century Europe, it is certainly true that print culture advanced circulation of ideas and opinions in an exponential transformation of what had been previously possible. But print culture was not the only medium of publicity and is not the only vehicle for public sphere formation. This is especially important for our discipline, as his view elides the role of orality and visuality, or alternatively, does not recognize the co-presence of multiple channels of communication circulation. In a discussion of Habermas in connection to Benedict Anderson's link of the national imagination to print capitalism, media scholar Arvind Rajagopal points out that print does not, in fact, eclipse older media. The evidence suggests the opposite. In colonial contexts, the attempt to discredit native modes of communication as lacking credibility, for example, rumor, only confirmed them as the favored means of mobilization. Old media could, in this way, experience a reinvigoration with the entry of print media, especially where literates were in a minority and mass movements occurred, unquote. Print culture also operates differently in the context of a multilingual society such as India or parts of Africa than in a nation unified by one language alone. The internet now also operates across languages with major emphasis on images and graphics. In this contemporary moment, cell phone technology, rather than computers, may be leading the way in internet distribution for multilingual societies, since it can trade in voice recognition and images rather than monolingual print-based text. Within the Indian context, computer science scholar K. Gopinath thinks that while internet is still prohibitive as an effective technology, democratic access technology in India due to cost, text, and language, quote, a low-cost cellular internet with good support infrastructure for voice applications and for Indian languages will change the landscape in ways that cannot be predicted, unquote. Of course, the value of internet access to all is also a topic for examination and debate. But for now, I'll push that back towards the end of the discussion. For all these problems, Habermas still offers important insights. As Roger Gopal reformulates Habermas's questions, he asks, what is the relation between a communicational form such as print and its socio-political context? What kinds of popular participation are made possible in a given context of publicity, and whose interests are best represented in a particular public sphere? Questions asked this way are less dependent on the limitations of Habermas's historical or normative ideas. They open onto more contemporary analyses and can be comparatively situated to reach a description of the public sphere that might be useful for our time. A number of thinkers have reworked this material, but I'm going to combine Michael Warner's theory coming out of American identity political struggles and Partha Chatterjee's theory of the relationship of nationalism to globalization in an attempt to reformulate a workable notion of public sphere operations. Michael Warner identifies counterpublics as alternative publics that come into being, creating an alternative or rival public culture. Quote, a counterpublic against the background of the public sphere enables a horizon of opinion and exchange. It exchanges remain distinct from authority and can have a critical relation to power. Its extent is in principle indefinite because it is not based on a precise demography, but mediated by print, theater, diffuse networks of talk, commerce, and the like, unquote. Warner explicitly mentions theater as one of the vehicles available to such counterpublics. And in other features, too, he calls attention to a wider range of behaviors and interventions than are normally thought of in the bourgeois public sphere. Not only need it not be bourgeois, but expressive speech, embodied styles of interaction, code switching, and linguistic polyphony are just some of the ways the emphasis can be shifted from a limited understanding of reason to what he calls poetic world-making, which has more room for sociability, affect, and play than a narrowly defined space of rational critical dialogue, which is actually coded for conventions of bourgeois style and already legitimated public deportment. The formation of a counterpublic may be of varying strengths relative to its socioeconomic position and its interests, but it is in principle open. It is a call to an imaginary addressee who may variously take up the offer. One of the problems with this theorization, however, is that it sounds like voluntarism. Publics come into being by virtue of individual will. However, in an age of state administration, global media, and limitless commodification, this voluntarism is certainly not credible. And Warner, in fact, draws attention to the mediation by commerce of some relations between counterpublics and the dominant, if imaginary, public. At this point, I wanted help understanding why the public sphere seems in turns to be hegemonic in league with the state and with global capital on the one hand, and on the other, seems truly a space of democratic practice or even resistance. I turned to Partha Chatterjee, distinguished historian and political scholar, who for many years worked between the Calcutta Institute of Social Science and Columbia University. Chatterjee gets at this problematic through his theorization of three separate arenas in public life, made up of the state, civil society, and political society. His ideas are part of his investigation of nationalism and the workings of the nation-state in a global time of the supposed post-nation, an idea he contests. The new term in these contexts, however, is political society. The distinction he wishes to make between civil and political society is initially an historical one. A key claim is, the most significant site of transformations in the colonial period is that of civil society. The most significant transformations occurring in the post-colonial period are in political society. Quote, Chatterjee sees the Indian colonial project of the independent-minded elites as based on models of civil society associated with modernity, including a desire for the virtues of the Enlightenment and of bourgeois freedom, whose known cultural forms were those of secularized Western Christianity. With the rise of mass movements and the establishment of actually existing Indian democracy, Chatterjee thinks that popular nationalism strained the associational forms of civic society, which were based on elite and bourgeois notions of modernity. And in order to achieve a new independent state order, other kinds of political activity and institutions grew up alongside those of so-called civil society. He concludes this part of his argument with this observation. The point is that the practices that activate the forms and methods of mobilization and participation in political society are not always consistent with the principles of association in civil society. In Chatterjee's analysis of present-day globalization, moreover, outside agents of economic liberalism often make common cause with the so-called civic values, such as humanitarianism or civil rights or environmentalism, to work through the civil institutions in ways that lead to neo-colonial penetration of ostensibly national interests and retardation of the larger project of establishing really existing democracy. In Chatterjee's examples, political solutions are sometimes improvised outside of the law or formal legitimate processes, but through informal public negotiations with governmentality. Chatterjee's conclusions apply beyond the Indian example. Quote, what these tendencies in many countries around the world reveal are the glaring inadequacies of the old forms of democratic representation, not only in the less modernized countries of the non-Western world, but in Western democracies themselves. The historical task is to work out new forms of democratic institutions and practices in the mediating field of political society that lies between civil society and the nation state, unquote. Now, this critique explains why, in theorizing the public sphere, it is important to see various sectors or publics as differentially connected to the state, civil society, and political society. I believe this distinction has utility not only for India and other post-colonial nations, but also in the West, where, as Chatterjee observed, institutions of civil society have also found to be inadequate and even counter-democratic. Arts in the public sphere. Well, if we recognize that most of the arts institutions, including theater and other performing arts, belong to the strata of civil society, we might better understand the growing impression in our discipline that direct political efficacy is practically impossible within state-supported and subsidized theaters, as well as within international arts events, festivals, or privately financed intercultural projects backed by transnational sponsors. Some scholars feel artists should opt out of these institutions altogether and seek other venues for their creative production. Others argue that there are possible collateral effects in some of these cases when counterpublics may recognize themselves in relation to these vehicles and eventually strengthen their power and ability to be politically effective as a counterpublic. The political power of popular culture could be seen in the early days of television, for example, when serialized programs, specials, appeared. Programs such as Roots in the United States, which put African-American slave histories on primetime in 1977, or the first showings of Shoah on German television in 1986, or the first epic television broadcasts of the Ramayana on Indian television in 1987. In these instances, certain formations of counterpublics and ways of doing oppositional politics were enabled even by state-controlled or partially controlled media. Of course, these counterpublic formations need not be progressive. In fact, they can as easily be reactionary. With the new mass consciousness of Black history in the case of Roots and of the Holocaust in the case of Shoah, there were important progressive expansions of democratic culture in those two cases. But in the case of the Ramayana on Indian television, owned and operated by the state, the reactionary Hindu elements of the ruling party were able to capitalize on huge new audiences for television to break away from the secular ideology of the early immediate post-independence era and attempt to call into being a specifically Hindu public. This accelerated the rise of Hindu nationalism and religious fundamentalism, but it did not succeed in covering over the deep differences within the Indian polity. Rajagopal, who I've quoted earlier, describes the effect of the Ramayana broadcasts as changing the contours of Indian politics permanently. Thus, what is true of all three examples is that counterpublics were formed as a result of these programs, in concert with other political factors as well, of course, which changed the face of the socio-political self-representation of the nation and its citizens, and therefore created new sites for democratic struggle within each. Theater as an institution has a difficult time showing up within this level of discussion of mass transmission through television, and the role of theater in general in the macro dynamics of society is always difficult to assess. Most distribution of performance is pretty local, or alternatively is exclusively distributed through circuits that are definitely part of civil society insofar as they are major state-supported arts institutions, international festivals, etc. On the other hand, when a particularly effective performance, let us say a devised performance by a community-based group, makes a performance of critical importance to the local audience that views it, it most often falls below the radar of the official archive. It is not that it cannot be documented, but that it will likely still escape wide attention, since it will be considered parochial. Yet what we need is a way of understanding the relationship of various forms of performance to the formation of counterpublics and their ultimate relations to the macrosphere of power and influence where governmentality controls populations, or within global media distribution where certain images and characterizations prevail over others. This analysis needed across the global national divide. Perhaps one way of circling back to the theater is by way of an older form of performance. I have been learning from Indian theater scholars working on women about the tensions between popular Indian cinema and the neglected folk art of tamasha. Tamasha performances involve dancing and singing by women before an audience of men and often contain a special erotic song called Lavani. As a customary part of the performance. Performers often come from the Dalit, or lowest caste, from the region called Maharashtra. My Indian pronunciation is still not very good. And are part of a community in which women work to provide the economic stability of the family. Tamasha performers usually are taught the dances by their mothers or aunts, and when they enter the profession, they cannot marry, although they often live and work for a man called a malik, who is a kind of manager or patron, and who usually has another family and a legal wife. Although the legal and economic well-being of the tamasha performer is always precarious, there is a kind of recognition and status that comes from performing well and from appearing in public, being, in fact, in the public sphere, while other women are separated into a private domestic sphere along strong public-private lines. A Kolhadi, member of a Rajasthani nomadic community who participates in tamasha, speaks about her predicament vis-a-vis the cinema, and this is the slide I put up for you. Dancing is our business and our art, but these days all kinds of women indulge in blatant prostitution under the guise of dancing. If our palu slips even a few inches off our chest, it causes a commotion. But heroines in movies dance with bodies exposed with a different hero each time, and it is called art. They go to Delhi and win awards for it. It's all a joke played on us by shameless people, unquote. What might we say here about the public sphere and the various counterpublics and dominant public, and especially about how to understand this tension politically? To the extent that it is an injustice, the informant is making a criticism of a lack of democratic extension to participate equally as a citizen and a woman in the Indian public sphere. On the other hand, the commercialization of sexuality in the popular cinema may not seem so liberatory in terms of really existing national values. On the contrary, it seems patently neoliberal and global in its freedoms. What would constitute democratic struggle for validation, formation of a counterpublic on behalf of this local performance tradition? Is there a way to mobilize the local performance tradition in critique of the global circulation of commercial material? And who would be hailed as this counterpublic? In such a situation, the Tamasha performers might become recognized as a public if they found ways to organize beyond their caste and in ways that put pressure on the government to protect the cultural heritage of their skilled dancing. But for women who are not used to this sort of political activity and organizing, perhaps this isn't a realistic goal. Some legal arrangements are now being negotiated to give these women rights to their earnings, especially after the death of their male partners, something they haven't had. Alternatively, kinship systems may also begin to change to accommodate the material needs of these women performers. The more difficult problem, as Lata Singh points out, is the degrading of the form through appropriation and commodification in the Bollywood cinema. This is much more difficult to combat. I want to briefly mention three other cultural practices that create new publics and introduce into the public sphere some democratic practices that are either outside the customary civic channels or even outside the law, thus operating in what Chatterjee identifies as the political rather than the civil arena. The first example comes from the work of Swedish performance scholar Ola Johansson, who is in the room, in fact, who has conducted extensive fieldwork in Tanzania on theater as a tool in AIDS prevention. Johansson has seen theater performances provide not instant problem-solving outcomes, but something much more subtle and lasting, communication about forms of daily behavior within communities, and public discussion of the codes and taboos that make such behavior hard to change. The value, as he sees it, is in setting up these networks of public communication, these performances and discussions, because they lay the groundwork for changes that may only come gradually or much later. Often, the village authorities do not value this kind of contribution because it indirectly challenges their authority and lessens their ability to control the population that they govern. The theater companies operate in these cases. In tension with the state or civic structures or NGOs, and in an ambiguous sphere where they risk losing the very support they need to continue their performances. Yet Johansson thinks this is the most important contribution community theater can make in response to the AIDS epidemic. Turning to Brazil, we find another kind of public being called into being by a Catalan artist and architect, Antoni Abad. Here the project was to give the means of self-representation to a group of men and a few women in São Paulo, Brazil, who carry messages on their scooters for a living and who are considered outside the social structure, rather like pariahs, most of whom also are illiterate. These messengers were given mobile phones with simple cameras, and the men were invited to simply document their lives with the cameras and post them on a website which the artist had set up for this purpose. Those who were literate would comment on the photos as well with tags. The artist did not do anything artful with the material. It was owned and used in a variety of ways by the people for whom it was intended. It created them as a public, or it let them create themselves as a public, and put them into the public sphere, but it was subject to whatever uses the subjects themselves desired to make of the material. Between 2003 and 2009, Abad has run projects with Mexican cab drivers, Madrid prostitutes, as well as these moto boys, as they are called. Finally, I return to my own nation of birth for my last example, where I continue to struggle to see how best to understand the tensions in the public sphere between populism and elitism, the state, civil society, and political society. The U.S., as you well know, has its own forms of social injustice. When I was back just now on research leave for a few months, I witnessed the elaborate healthcare debates in which the richest country in the world voiced intense opposition to guaranteeing healthcare for all its citizens. This is a situation in which the state and its civil institutions has definitely not lived up to the ideals of liberal democracy, as millions of Americans have not had access to health insurance. At the present time, many emergency rooms and hospitals will not turn away critically ill people, whether or not they are insured, whether or not they are citizens or undocumented workers, for example, from Mexico. But beyond this emergency treatment, any further treatments or course of treatment may be denied them, and even being treated at all falls within Chatterjee's notion of the political society rather than the civil, because these actions occur only on an ad hoc basis and are not protected or provided for under the law. They are improvised accommodations to an unjust situation, leaving these patients outside the law and outside the protections of citizenship. There is a popular television series some of you may know called Mercy, which, by the way, I only saw from the UK this year. It's a hospital drama featuring three female nurses, one of whom served as a military nurse in the Iraq War. In the week just before the vote, the program centered on an African-American patient with no health insurance who needed heart surgery, and on the decision of the doctor and the nurse to go against hospital policy and perform an illegal operation in order to save his life. Meanwhile, the second nurse figure was being questioned by police for aiding a patient in termination of her life in the face of an incurable and degenerative illness. Both episodes were about acting through civil institutions, but really outside the law, and the politics of the drama were clearly in favor of these procedures. The juxtaposition of this program to the political debates I had been witnessing about healthcare reform made me aware once again that simply negating major media entertainment performances is too simple a judgment in trying to understand how the public sphere operates and how counterpublics can make use of various forms of appeal and deliberation. It appears to me that many different forms of public discourse and public performances shape the public sphere, and that resistance can sometimes be found in unlikely places. And on this somewhat inconclusive note, I'll end.
Thank you very much. We have time for a few direct questions to Janelle. It's working. Anything you want to ask Janelle about? Are you setting up your computer in the meantime? So we have sort of simultaneous actions going on. Yes. Shane.
Thank you very much for that. I just have one quick question, and it's probably something that Freddie and I'm sure we'll hear a lot today, actually Shannon Jackson already kind of talked about, and that's the limit of this term, the counterpublic. I was particularly struck by one of your last slides, which it looks like a Tea Party rally of some sort, so a very right-wing populist rally, and you said, is this a counterpublic? And you know, in some ways, it really is, but it brings to mind, like, so what is the difference between, how do we distinguish between a counterpublic and, say, a populist movement or opposition, and if it is very, very difficult to decide, what is the value in maintaining or keeping this term counterpublic when it seems like it can be used to describe many, many different projects from all different ideologies, etc. And you know, maybe as another term that might be more productive, you know, Habermas in, I think in the introduction to the transformation of the public sphere, he talks about this idea of the proletarian public sphere. So this idea of a completely different project that actually has a project, and that's not just oppositional or counter in some way.
I can just speak, right? You can hear me? I don't need to even go address it. Well, thank you for your question, and also for linking it to Shannon Jackson's talk this morning, because that's been on my mind as well. And I think actually I'm trying to struggle with something that she is interested in too, which is how to maintain some links to the existing democratic structures, perhaps strengthen them, and still critique them, and how that works. I'd say a couple of things. The first thing is that one of my current projects is to point out every time I can where a particular structure can be used either for progressive ends or for reactionary ends, and the structure itself is sort of value neutral. And I think counterpublics is one of those structures. And I also was talking about the first flush of when television first began to broadcast those serials. And three examples, but two of them were progressive and one of them wasn't, for the same reason, in order to show that there is nothing inherently progressive about that first democratizing burst
that came out of opening access. And in fact, access itself is democratizing in terms of inclusion, but the result may be, if it's a reactionary public, then it's going to be a reactionary result. Now, I don't think that discredits the concept. I think a counterpublic is not inherently progressive, but the reason why it's a useful term or a useful concept is because we need some terminology that shows how something can come up apart from or different from the kind of hegemonic or full public sphere. And then it can either be, I mean, there are a lot of options. It can be incorporated into the dominant public sphere. It can get strong enough that it lobbies and changes what is dominant. It can have a certain solidarity in itself and maintain itself apart from the dominant public sphere. I think that's a counterpublic. But I think that it can be a right-wing neo-Nazi group as well as a group that we might think of as productive. There was one other point I wanted to make to you, but I'm going to let it go. I can't remember what it is right now. If I can think of it, I'll say it at the end.
Okay. Thank you. And we'll go on now with the lecture by a talk by Annalisa Sacchi. She's a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Bologna, where she also completed her PhD on memory theater and memorability. During her research, she studied at the Warburg Institute for 1 year, and here is that will be part of her discussion also today. She has edited a book with Romeo Castellucci in French, Itinera, about Tragedia Endogonadia, and she is the editor since 2004 of a journal in Italian called Art O, and the topic of her talk today is a public space for ghosts. Please.
Thank you, Fred. So, I will analyze very briefly today the role, the impact, and the possibilities of a community of people that have nothing in common. A community that shares nothing but a loss, as I suggest in the title of my paper, A Ghost. For doing so, let me first start with the story of Abby Warburg, the German scholar who invented the iconology and created the Warburg Institute. The image and fame of Abby Warburg, the studies inspired by his vision of psychohistory, as well as concepts like pathos formel, afterlife of classical antiquity, and dynamogram, have acquired such a vast public, outside as well within academic circle, that it has been possible to speak of a popular image of the Warburg Institute. Yet, this growth in the fame of the Institute has been accompanied by an increasing obliteration of the figure of the Institute's founder and his original project. For its whole life, Warburg was occupied amassing one of the strangest libraries in the world. A prophetic childhood experience lies at its origin. At the age of 13, Abby, who was the firstborn son of a family of bankers, offered to give his right of primogeniture to his younger brother Max in exchange for the promise that his brother would buy him all the books he wanted. Max accepted, surely without realizing that his brother's childhood joke would one day become reality. Dedicated to the broad field of what the German call Kulturwissenschaft, the humanities and social sciences, the library's most striking feature was its principle of organization. Works were not classified by subject, author, title, or even date of acquisition, but instead by what Warburg called the law of good neighbor, which states that the solution of one's own problem is contained not in the book one is looking for, but in the one beside it. Though grouped under such general rubrics as anthropology or art history, both the various sections and the books within them were arranged as a function of their ability to engage with the books of either side of them. A line of speculation opened in one volume was attested to, or attacked, continued or contradicted, refined or refuted in its neighbor. Upon first visiting the library in the 1920s, the German philosopher Ernst Cassirer, one of the most erudite men of that time, declared that he saw only two options, to leave immediately or to stay for years. A systematic man, Cassirer did the one and then returned and do the other. Warburg thus transformed the library into a kind of a labyrinthine image of himself, one whose power of attraction was enormous. Like a true maid, the library led the reader to his or her goal, leading him or her astray from one good neighbor to another in a series of detours at the end of which he fatally encountered the Minotaur that had been waiting for him from the beginning, who was, in a certain sense, Warburg himself. Whoever has worked in the library knows how true this is even today, despite the concessions that have been made over the years to the demands of contemporary organizational principles. For most of Warburg's life, the library was housed in his private dwelling, although it was accessible for the public and increasingly used by the scholarly community. This semi-public space, or public space for a particular community, hosts Warburg's collection of 1,000 volumes, and in its original space in Hamburg, it staged the panels of his lifelong project, Mnemosyne, the atlas that should recapitulate his nameless science. Mnemosyne was conceived as a gigantic condenser for gathering energy currents that continue to animate Europe's memory in the form of its ghosts. By gazing upon this atlas of images, which he saw as movements frozen at the moment of their greatest intensity, the good European, as Warburg said, would become conscious of the problematic nature of his own cultural tradition, perhaps succeeding thereby in, I quote, educating himself and in healing his own schizophrenia, end of quote. According to Warburg, images possessed tremendous energy with the potential to make humans regress or guide him, her, or is her path of knowledge, Mnemosyne, as the history of art more generally has been enigmatically described by Warburg as, quote, a ghost story for truly adult people, end of quote. Thus, according to Warburg's idea, the library was the public space in which a particular community of scholars could share this ghost story. A scholar addressing a phantom recalls irresistibly the opening of Hamlet. At the spectral apparition of the dead father, Marcellus implores Horatio, quote, "Thou art a scholar, speak to it, Horatio," end of quote. Jacques Derrida has been fascinated by this scene and has written something about it that might be interesting in our case. I quote, "Marcellus appeals to the scholar or to the learned intellectual, to the man of culture, as a spectator who better understands how to establish the necessary distance or how to find the appropriate words for observing, better yet, for apostrophizing the ghost, which is to say also for speaking the language of kings or of the dead," end of quote. And that's where the Derrida again. Though the classical scholar did not believe in phantoms and truly would not know how to speak to them, even forbidding himself to do so, it is quite possible that Marcellus had anticipated the coming of a scholar of the future, a scholar who, in the future, and so as to conceive of the future, would dare to speak to the phantom. End of quote. One of the scholars of the future is no doubt Abby Warburg, who eventually animated and permitted the emergence of a community of scholars capable of speaking with the ghosts. A community that has nothing in common but thousands of ghosts, that shares nothing but a lack, which are simultaneously the condition of possibility and the manifest content of the Warburg Institute. So, what kind of community is that doesn't have an appropriative status? Italian philosopher Roberto Esposito is surely the one who carried the idea of a community originates from nothing to its extreme. In his book, Communitas, Origin and Destiny of the Community, recently translated in English and published by Stanford University Press, he starts underlining how community is conceived by the tradition of political philosophy and in mostly of the cultures of intersubjectivity as a property, belonging to subjects and joining them. Community is thus an attribute, a definition, a predicate that qualifies its members as belonging to the same totality, or as a substance that is produced by their union. In each case, community is conceived of as a quality that is added to their nature as subjects, making them also subjects of community. More profoundly, subjects, subjects of a larger entity that shares a good, a value, an essence, which can eventually be lost and then refound as something that once belonged to us and that therefore can once again belong to us. In each case, community is most properly our own, the community being tied to the semantic of proprium. If we reflect upon community following Esposito and without consider contemporary models, the most paradoxical aspect is that common is defined exactly through its most obvious antonym. What is common is that which unites the ethnic, territorial, and spiritual property of every one of its members. The radical turn in Esposito's argument comes at the very beginning of his Communitas, where he distances himself from this dialectic and seeks to, I quote, lead to a notion of community that is radically different from those that have been dealt with up to now, end of quote. Esposito's achievement is to reset the term on which community can be thought by discovering in the roots of our modern conception of community the void of the debt or gift. Quote from Esposito. In communitas, there is another meaning to be added, one, however, less obvious, because it transfers properly within itself the larger semantic complexity of the term from which it originates, munus, cum munus, cum means with munus. Its archaic form is moinus, moinus, which is composed of the root mei and the suffix nes, both of which have a social connotation. The term, in fact, oscillates in turn among three meanings that aren't all the same and that seem to make it miss its mark, or at least to limit the emphasis, the initial juxtaposition of public, private, in favor of another conceptual area that is completely traceable to the idea of obligation. These are onus, officium, and donum. End of quote. It is interesting to underline here that in order to trace such a genealogy, Esposito has to speak the language of the debts, Latin. In Italy, students are trained both in Latin and in ancient Greek since the secondary school, and these two matters are called lingua morte, dead languages, namely languages no more spoken, or languages spoken by the debts. Munus is a particular kind of gift, since the Latins understood it only as the gift given and never as the gift received. Munus is the gift that has to be given and that therefore will establish a lack. Thus, according to Esposito, communitas means the being in common of what has no common origin, but is originated by a loss, a monk, some monk in Lacanian terms, a ghost. I realize that I'm forcing slightly the concept of munus, yet what else does the fall of the stability of a possession open up if not a logic of loss, subtraction, transfer? Only lack is common, not possession, property, or appropriation. Exactly the same idea of loss and transfer that animates Warburg's conceiving about the collective memory and its ghosts. But how can one define categorically and historically a community of this kind? Esposito tries to do that by turning to a meaning which has the same diachronic profundity and the same semantic power of the concept to that which it refers by way of contrast, and shares with it the same etymological and conceptual foundation. Such a meaning is linked with the immunization, derived by way of extension from the Latin term immunitas, which is precisely tied to that of communitas from the relation in the former negative and in the latter positive with the lemma munus. If the members of the communitas are joined together by the same law, by the duties or gift that they have to give, immunis is instead he who is exempt or exonerated from them, he who does not have obligations with respect to the other, and who can therefore conserve entirely his own proper essence as subject who is owner of himself. As we know, in biomedical language, one understands immunity to be a form of exemption or protection in relation to a disease. In juridical language, immunity represents a sort of safeguard that places the one who holds it in a condition of untouchability vis-à-vis common law. In both cases, therefore, immunity or immunization alludes to a particular situation that protects someone from a risk or a contagion, to which an entire community is exposed. At this point, my underlying theses are essentially two. The first is about the role of the immunization in our contemporary experience. The second concerns the possibility that the instantaneous community joined together during the performance event can deconstruct the pervasive role of the immunization. In fact, immunitary dispositive, that is basically a demand for exemption or protection, which originally were only awarded the medical and juridical spheres, was over time extended to all those other sectors and languages of our life until it becomes the coagulating point, both real and symbolic, of the entire contemporary experience and public sphere. Certainly, this preoccupation with self-protection doesn't only belong to our own period. All societies, just as all individuals, have been concerned with assuring their own survival with respect to the risk of environmental or interhuman contamination. But the threshold of knowledge, when faced with the risk of contagion, and therefore the kind of response that is required, was very different over the course of time until it reaches its apex precisely in our own period. In a democracy dominated by the principle of immunization, the public sphere emerges against every communitarian temptations as the site in which men enter into relation with each other in the form of their dissociation. Here it arises the need for strategy and control apparatuses that allow them to live nearby without coming into contact, and therefore to increase the sphere of individual self-sufficiency through the use of masks that protect them from insidious contact with the other. It is precisely here that I believe a community like that originated from Warburg, or the one joined together during a performance or a spectacle, manifests a state of exception. This crucial difference helps us to better understand the weight which the public of theatre as a community carries or could carry. For the lack of immunization of a community that shares ghosts and that is somehow affected by ghosts is a kind of resistance from the immunitary dispositive, a lack that eventually exposes the members of a community to a risk, to a contagion. In this light, one has to rethink also the sentence of Warburg about his own schizophrenia. I quote, "Sometimes it looks to me, to me as if, in my role as a psychohistorian, I try to diagnose the schizophrenia of Western civilization from its images in an autobiographical reflex," end of quote. And we have to reconsider also Antonin Artaud's famous call for a theater of the contagion. And it is not by chance that one of the most important studies of Georges Bataille on the matter of contagion is about drama and spectacle, that he intends as the originary form of the contagious contagion, namely, the event in which the contagion, the compenetration of two beings, is contagious, capable of infinite reverberations. Here we have to do a step backwards. The archaic form of immunization practiced by the primitive communities is the immunization from death. Since the death is contagious, mostly of the mourning rites, as analyzed by Edgar Morin, among others, pay a particular attention to the separation of the relatives of the dead person from the rest of humanity. The mourning period is nothing else than the period when people close to the dead person have to purify their impurity, a period that often coincides with the length of the temporary sepulture. If theatre is an experience of ghostly reappearance of something that, using Herbert Blau's word, we saw before, it is also an experience in which spectators are somehow affected by this loss. We know, as Roland Barthes has stated, the original relation of the theatre and the cult of the dead. The first actors separated themselves from the community by playing the role of the dead. To make oneself up was to designate oneself as a body simultaneously living and dead. For example, the whitened bust of the totemic theater, the man with the painted face in the Chinese theater, the rice-paste makeup of the Indian katakali, the Japanese no mask. And Walter Benjamin has once postulated that the role of the orchestra in the Greek theaters was that of separating the dead from the living. I quote, "This abyss," he writes, "that bears the traces of its sacred origin most indelibly among all the elements of the stage," end of quote. "This abyss that prevents from the infection of the dead is lost in Elizabethan period. And totally lost it results in modern theatre, radically lost if we recognize in the name of Hamlet the founding myth of the modernity. For Hamlet is the name of the hero of modern theatre, but it is at the same time the name of the dead father that returns in a ghostly appearance, since Hamlet starts with a contact that infects the son with the death of the father, a contact in which the prince isn't immunized and that infects the entire community, the one of the Denmark court, as well the community of the spectators. And maybe it is not by chance that it is exactly in the Elizabethan period that arises the restoration of the idea of public, the public theater and the public of the play. Because in theater, the public is of the same sort of the communitas analyzed by Esposito, a community that shares a story of ghosts and that is exposed to a risk.
Any questions? Many questions.
Yes.
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much. To begin with, this last remark of yours concerning Benjamin, that in Baroque theater, according to Benjamin analysis, there is an important separation: the world of living being and beings and dead. Being's other world, but it's only the prince who is in charge of this division in a certain sense, or in a very precise sense. And that is also the reason for the melancholy of Hamlet, who was a hero of a Baroque theater par excellence, according to Benjamin. But what about now? Do you mean, did I understood you well, that now the community, this question of death and should be encountered in somehow in a more collective way? How does it take place according to you? how death becomes our common affair.
Okay, there are some images running behind me, and this one in particular is one of the latest episodes of the tragedy in Dogonidio. When this project by Romeo Castellucci and Societas Raffaello Sanzio. In this work, for example, in this particular case in Strasbourg, a tank entered the theater. And it's quite scaring as an experience, but it's not the goal, the reason for this tank to enter is not a theatrical effect, it's because Romeo wants us to know that our life as spectators is constantly in risk. And it's not something hypothetical. I mean, before the rise of electricity, the medium life of a theater was 50 years, and then once. So it was really a matter of life, going to theater. That's why Antonin Artaud, after the invention of electricity, made this fantastic thought about theater and plug, danger in theater, this dangerous experience. I don't know if I asked your question.
I said, one more. So, maybe we're... Yes, Laura?
I was wondering if there's a differentiation to be made between Warburg and Esposito, and if there is, would it be one that's based on a kind of positivity of difference through the idea of something like good neighborliness, in contrast to this idea of what you have in common is lack. So on the one hand, there seemed to be an argument within your paper where what we have in common is not an identity, but it's nevertheless positive in the sense, you know, it's a positive relation, or it's this, you know, capacity to connect that you spoke about in relation to the books. But then on the other hand, there was this emphasis on lack and as a community connected only by loss. And I wonder if you could say a bit more about whether or not you think that you believe that distinction to be accurate.
Okay. Okay. The law of good neighbor, it's one central point, one core point in the Warburg Institute. But these books contained a story of ghosts. So topic for me is not the organization of the institute, but the content of these books. And so for me it's really inspiring, the idea of a story of ghosts for truly old people, which is one of the most mysterious, enigmatical sentences by Warburg.
Okay. Thank you very much. Now I want to introduce myself. I'm a professor of theater studies at Tel Aviv University, and I want to mention two publications, Performing History, which was published about 10 years ago, and the most recent is Philosophers and Thespians, Thinking Performance, published this year by Stanford University Press. The name of my topic now is The Public Sphere, Where Modalities of Representation Congregate. I want to begin by confessing that my motives for exploring the public sphere are very personal. They express the urgency I feel to understand how the public sphere in Israel is constituted and to explore my own role as an academic, or if you wish, an intellectual within this public sphere. These efforts have been triggered by the profound agitation and distress, to put it as mildly as possible, and this was written before the last debacle and mistakes and the terrible things that happened, that fundamental moral and democratic values are no longer of primary concern in today's Israeli society. This perception is not new. I believe we reached a critical point, even a state of extreme emergency, already a long time ago, when the state of Israel, which was to serve as a corrective to the catastrophic failures of history, became implicated by its own failures to practice and to defend those universal moral values on the basis of which it was founded. Even if Israel is not the only country in the world where such values are not practiced or honored, it is the place where I have chosen to live. Today, I will, however, not discuss the current situation in the Middle East or how it has become what it is. Neither will I examine individual expressions of Israeli art and performance. Instead, I want to present some preliminary ideas and distinctions that I believe would enable us to examine the notion of the public sphere and the role and function of artistic creativity, in particular of theater and performance, within such a broadly defined public sphere. These ideas have been inspired by Jürgen Habermas and Hannah Arendt, and they need to be further explored and developed beyond the scope of a conference paper. And the example I want to discuss briefly is a comedy by Aristophanes called Thesmophorasiousai, meaning the women celebrating the festival of Thesmophoria, which was first performed in 411 BC, an unusual metatheatrical text even by today's standards, where the basic issues concerning the public sphere I want to raise here have been very poignantly expressed. And in parenthesis, this is an expression of my own belief of a long durée of modernity starting somewhere in the Greek polis, which I basically argued for in the book on philosophers and thespians. In what follows, I want to suggest that an important aspect of the public sphere is constructed through a tightly knit network of modalities of representation, and the particular forms in which these modalities congregate, Besides a broad range of aesthetic representations, these modalities also include, for example, political or parliamentary representation, legal forms of representation, including also economic and religious systems of representation, as well as the strategies of representation expressed through various discursive practices like historiography and philosophy. Also, the broad range of representations of gender, color, age, and education, etc., just to mention a few expressions related more directly to the status of the individual subject within the public sphere, are part of this complex and multi-leveled network of representations. Many of the modalities of representation refer to other forms of representation, like in critical discourses about democracy and parliamentary forms of representation, or in most aesthetic representations, as well as in narratives of national or civic identity, public monuments, and rituals. The borderlines between the different modalities are not always clear. This results in a dense system of representational practices which become intertwined and interconnected through the network which in itself, as such a network, constitutes the basis for the public sphere. However, among all these forms of representation, aesthetic representation holds a central, even privileged position, frequently contesting and even subverting the mandate and legitimacy of the other representational practices. This constant, sometimes total involvement and even direct confrontation with other modalities of representation is one of the distinguishing features of the aesthetic sphere. A work of art constantly challenges the other modalities, while it at the same time holds unique possibilities to examine its own strategies of representation through a broad range of meta-aesthetic discourses and self-reflective strategies of representation. The ontological instability, and this is a term which is important to understand art, I think, the ontological instability of the aesthetic object is the basic reason for this unique position of aesthetic representations within the public sphere. Many cultural critics and theoreticians would no doubt claim that the modalities of representation are very different from each other, that they are incongruous and can therefore only with great effort, if at all, be examined within the same conceptual framework. Even an insightful critic like Christopher Prendergast, following Derrida, has argued that the concept of representation, and this is a quote, behaves in a whole society, in a whole variety of different ways according to the context, intellectual discipline, and object of inquiry, end quote, stressing the diversity of uses rather than a common denominator. Instead, I would like to suggest that the public sphere is constituted by the sum of its representational practices. This is the public sphere, and the disparity between these representational strategies is an expression of the unique complexity of this public sphere. But at the same time as there is a great variety between the distinct modalities of representation, they are all, regardless if they are based on political, parliamentary, legal, economic, gender, aesthetic, or any other modality, constituted through mechanisms of inclusion and exclusion. Janelle, in her talk, went somewhere in that direction, but I want to be more explicit. Such schemas of inclusion and exclusion, and of course also death is the ultimate form of exclusion, such schemas of inclusion and exclusion are of course not identical if we are focusing on the parliamentary system, discussing issues of gender or religious affiliation, or analyzing a work of performance art. However, all the representational practices are based on strategies of inclusion and exclusion. And we have to take both the inclusions and the exclusions into consideration, because every representational practice creates a specific repertoire by selecting certain items from a repository, just like the specific parole in de Saussure's analysis of language relates to a pre-existing langue. And I must gather, and I must already emphasize that I'm not afraid or reluctant to rely on a paradigm with strong structuralist component. The interaction between whom or what has been included or excluded from a certain representational practice is the most basic principle for ruling and regulating the political power structures as well as the legal practices of a certain country or regime. This is also the most basic mechanism for regulating all other institutional and social practices of the public sphere. And within the aesthetic sphere, the selection processes that serve as the basis for a work of art are also based on a broad range of complex interactions between inclusions and exclusions. One of the earliest expressions of this that come to mind is Aristotle's definition of tragedy as the mimesis of an action. In order to create such a mimesis, regardless if it is translated as imitation or representation, the strategies for what has been included within the depiction of such an action and what has been excluded from it is finally what counts, also for Aristotle. In the structural transformation of the public sphere, and it's important that it has the name, that it has the word structural in it, first published in 1962, Habermas defined the public sphere, the Öffentlichkeit, as an open and transparent field co-inhabited by the official government authorities and the individual citizens. The public sphere is constituted through a critical and rational exchange of ideas between them, supposedly free from social and economic pressures. Habermas constructed a public sphere where all the participants basically treat each other as equals in their shared efforts to reach an understanding on matters of common concern. This almost utopian public sphere is the locus where agreements are reached and accommodations negotiated, where individual citizens can intervene actively in the implementation of governmental actions, supporting as well as contesting them, and it is governed by inclusions and exclusions. Habermas does not, however, only view the public sphere as an idyllic haven of agreement and accommodation constituted by law-abiding, rational citizens reading newspapers while drinking their morning coffee. Rather, from his relatively early post-World War II perspective, he clearly stated that, quote, "For about a century, the social foundations of this sphere have been caught up in a process of decomposition," end quote. Adding that, quote, "tendencies pointing to the collapse of the public sphere are unmistakable, for while its scope is expanding impressively, its function has become progressively insignificant. If you are successful in gaining a historical understanding of the structures of this complex that today, confusedly enough, we subsume under the heading public sphere, we can hope to attain thereby not only a sociological clarification of the concept, but a systematic comprehension of our own society from the perspective of one of its central categories," and Habermas. At the same time, as the signs of collapse of the public sphere are unmistakable, we still, however, Habermas argues, require this category as a rational regulatory instrument in order to understand and analyze our societies. I agree with this, but only as a point of departure. Examining the regulatory mechanism of the public sphere from our own 2010 perspective, it is not possible to talk anymore about the sociological clarification or the systematic comprehension of our own society that the public sphere can supposedly provide as an analytical or rational category. Rather, the tensions between the supposed rationality of the public sphere and its complex mechanisms of inclusion and exclusions on which it is based lead to an insoluble aporia in Habermas' thinking. Instead, the public sphere has to be defined and analyzed on the basis of its ongoing crisis, the ongoing state of crisis, its ongoing state of emergency, and its sudden, unexpected changes. Because of the inherent symbiosis between violence and exclusion, this makes any discussion of inclusion and exclusion even more complex but necessary. The public sphere is a space of contention and discord, frequently even endangering the democratic processes and the forms of tolerance on which it depends for its existence. The public has even become synonymous with crisis and unresolved strife. And most importantly, ideological strategies are implemented to exclude large groups of citizens from the public sphere by economic, administrative, and legal measures. This has no doubt been the case in my own country, Israel, where Palestinian Israeli citizens in different ways become excluded from the active participation in what is now officially defined by the oxymoron, a Jewish democracy, an ethnocracy rather than a democracy, not to talk about the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Ernesto Laclau has argued that the modernist notion of limitless representability has been replaced by an understanding, quote, that representation is the name of an undecidable game that organizes a variety of social relations, but whose operations cannot be fixed in a rational, graspable, and ultimately univocal mechanism, end of quote. However, in order to reach an understanding of the sense of urgency expressed through the arts within this chaotic public sphere and their limited ability to intervene with in this irrational field still termed the public sphere, and I propose we stick to this problematic notion, we need to formulate an understanding of representation that takes us beyond the political of Laclau's thinking at the same time as it includes it. The interdependence between the public sphere and the notion of representation, including the aesthetic forms of expression, has a long and complex history. I will only be able to point out some of the issues very briefly here. According to Habermas, they go back to the feudal world of the High Middle Ages, when the English king enjoyed, quote, publicness as something publicly represented or embodied. This aspect of representation is not only an expression of status and hegemony in the public sphere, but also the display in public as an embodiment of some sort of higher power. This embodiment is obviously performative, relying simultaneously on several distinct modes of representation, parliamentary or political, legal, economic, religious, metaphysical, as well as a broad range of aesthetic and performative modes of representation, which in the last book I call scripted embodiments. In each of these modes of representation, the embodiment is activated in different but partially overlapping ways. This double bind of representation as a mechanism or a strategy that activates embodiment at the same time as it is activated by the forms of exchange and other social contracts, including the strategies of inclusion and exclusion that I emphasized before, some of which do not abide to what we generally consider to be rational, is of central importance for the performative nature of the modalities of representation within the public sphere and for performance as a specific form of representation. In making his basic distinction, Habermas also relies on Hans-Georg Gadamer's commentaries in Truth and Method, and his etymological extrapolation of the notion of representation. According to Gadamer, during the medieval period, the classical Greek and Roman notion of copy, mimesis, and to make present, representare, gradually became transformed into replacement, pointing out that someone or something replaces another person or object, taking his or her or its role. These principles of representation, I believe, are also related or deeply related to the notion of imitatio, mainly carrying religious significance. The public sphere and its discords, the state of emergency through which it is constituted, and the sense of urgency it triggers for the individual create a complex network of inclusions, and embodiments where the relationships between them function differently in each case. The issue I want to address in my future research is how this broad range of representational practices intersect and are interwoven with, as well within, aesthetic representations, and under which circumstances these aesthetic representations express this urgency in relation to the other forms, to which extent it is critiquing them, and under which circumstances it can undermine and even subvert these other forms of representation, in particular their most problematic exclusions. The deepened understanding of these strategies of exclusion can also serve as the basis for introducing an ethical dimension, where the notion of urgency expresses the tensions, the caesuras, and the confrontations between these modes or modalities of representation. For Hannah Arendt, whose thinking has a strong ethical ground, the public sphere is comprised of two distinct but interrelated dimensions. The first is a space of appearance, where political freedom and equality come into being whenever citizens act through the medium of speech and persuasion. The second is the common world, a shared and public world of human artifacts, institutions, and settings, which separates us from nature and which provides a relatively permanent and durable context for our activities. The more relevant aspects for discussion of the arts, and as Paul Kottman has very convincingly shown in his recent book, The Politics of the Scene, of the theater in particular, is the space of appearance. Whereas Arendt formulated it, quote, "I appear to others as others appear to me," where men exist not merely like other living or inanimate things, but to make their appearance explicitly, end quote. Such a public space of appearance can be recreated when individuals gather together in a political context, that is, quote, "whenever men are together in the manner of speech and action," or, in my terms, where practices of representation congregate. However, since it is a creation of an action, this space of appearance is highly fragile and exists only when actualized through the performance of deeds or the utterance of words. Its particularity, Arendt also argued, is that unlike the spaces which are the work of our hands, it does not survive the actuality of the movement which brought it into being, but disappears not only with the dispersal of men, as in the case of great catastrophes, when the body politic of people is destroyed, but with the disappearance or arrest of the activities themselves. Wherever people gather together, it is potentially there, but only potentially, not necessarily, and not forever. Within such a space, and Peggy Phelan's earlier work would sort of reiterates this, the creative activities of artists will also be able to appear, adding an additional reflexive dimension to the activities of the public sphere, and then they disappear. I will end with a short presentation, definitely not yet an in-depth analysis, of a play which I found fascinating that relates directly to the issues I have raised with regard to the public sphere, the women celebrating the festival of Thesmophoria by Aristophanes. It will be more a summary of the play, but you will see how the different things I've been talking about begin to come together in an aesthetic context. Besides its markedly meta-theatrical characteristics, this farcical comedy contains a level of intertextual sophistication that only very few of our own contemporary artistic expressions only rarely achieve. It also relates directly to several of the modalities of the representation that constitute the public sphere. The basic conceit of the play is that the women celebrating their annual celebration of Demeter and Persephone want to punish Euripides, the playwright, for having insulted them through his negative depiction of female characters in his plays. The husbands often return home from the theater full of suspicions towards their wives. As a result of this, Euripides' literary representations have become a legal issue, which could lead in some form of prosecution of Euripides, something which he wants to prevent them from carrying out. He therefore approaches his colleague, the playwright Agathon, who was the winner of the contest of tragedies celebrated in Plato's Symposium, which took place 5 years before the play by Aristophanes was first premiered. Agathon, whose plays have all vanished, was known for his effeminate behavior, which makes Euripides believe that by sending him to talk to the women, they will be convinced that he is not a criminal and that his plays have not been written with the intention to harm the women. But since Agathon believes that the women of Athens are jealous of him, he refuses to attend the festival for fear of being discovered. Instead, as he, Agathon, is dressed up as a woman because he's just writing a female part in one of his own plays, he lends some of his clothes to Euripides' kinsman, Menesilochus. As the kinsman arrives at the festival site dressed up as a woman, he enthusiastically defends Euripides by pointing out that women are in fact cheating their husbands, presenting a view of women that is much more negative than Euripides had ever shown in any of his plays, telling the assembled women detailed stories about female treachery. We must, of course, keep in mind that Aristophanes has written a biting satire, though it is easy to see how complex and ironically tongue-in-cheek the references to the representational issues in this play are. Through the kinsman, Aristophanes presents ideas about women that are much more extreme than female characters in Euripides' plays, like Phaedra, as depicted in the play Hippolytus, for example. Eventually, the women receive a message that a man disguised as a woman, and the message is brought by another man who always wears women's clothes so he can safely enter this sacred space for the women, has infiltrated the ritual space, spreading untruths in order to defend Euripides, and as a result, the kinsman is eventually discovered. In the midst of the ensuing arguments, when the women are trying to catch him, the kinsman grabs a baby child from one of the women, mimicking a scene from Euripides' play, Telephos, which has only survived in fragments, about a king with that name who has been wounded by Agamemnon and can only be cured by the same person who wounded him. Dressed up as a beggar, he enters Agamemnon's court, and when he is discovered by Achilles, he snatches the baby child Orestes, from the cradle to get cured by the same person who wounded him. I really want to acknowledge Fruma Zeitlin's really interesting analysis of this, but there has been, since about the mid-80s, towards the beginning of the 90s, there is a growing literature on this very special play. So, as the kinsman opens the bundle with the baby, he discovers that the woman has been hiding a skin pouch with wine dressed up as a baby, which again, on an additional level, compromises the women at the festival. At the same time, it also introduces the Dionysian theme into this theatricalized presentation of the ritual. Meanwhile, the male authorities are notified of the illegal presence of a man at the women-only festival. The kinsman is arrested and strapped to a plank by a policeman, and a series of farcical scenes in which Euripides, in a desperate attempt to rescue his kinsman, comes and goes in various disguises in scenes taken from his own plays where different forms of rescue have been depicted. But the scheme to model the escape of the kinsman on fictional ones using theatrical scenes in order to rescue him ultimately fails. An extremely high level of literacy and profound grasp of social processes are necessary in order to understand these sophisticated meta-theatrical conceits. The ability to decipher them, these complex modalities of representation, must no doubt have given the spectators an immense enjoyment and even aesthetic pleasure. But in spite of this, maybe even because of this, the play is a biting satire which no doubt had a subversive potential. The play ends with a tragic poet finally deciding to appear as himself in this capacity, and in this capacity he negotiates a peace with a chorus of women, securing their cooperation by providing a promise not to insult them in his future plays. So this has a moral. However, the women declined to help him release the kinsman, now a prisoner of the Athenian state, but agree not to interfere with the plans for his escape. Disguised, finally, as an old lady and attended by a dancing girl and a flute player, Euripides, with the help of the chorus, distracts the policeman long enough to enable his kinsman to escape, and the comedy ends happily. So this is an example, I think, which also has to be contextualized within the political historical context of the crisis of the Athenian polis at this time, which is also referred to in different ways. I present it as a sort of a pilot, really as a pilot project to see where how the modalities of representation congregate. Thank you. So now there is time for a question to me. And then we will all sit on the stage and we can have a discussion. We have another 20 minutes, at least, if there is a question.
So I was hoping to ask you to follow up on your claim that the public sphere can be understood as the sum of representational practices. And I'd like to put a little bit of pressure just on that one trope, because it seems like maybe it doesn't quite accord with the later account that you're giving of the way in which individual representational practices have a sort of constitutive exclusionary violence. And it would seem as if we think of the public sphere as a sum, that would imply that all of these representational practices add up, and that there's a way in which some sort of hypothetical observer could comprehend them all from a place in which he or she wasn't, you know, him or herself implicated or interpolated by them. It would seem particularly in the context of debates about representation within, you know, the sort of paradoxical Jewish democracy that you mentioned, that these issues are amplified that much further. And so I guess I'm wondering if you could comment on that tension. And the one thought that I had was that maybe if we are going to think of the public sphere as aggregating different sort of representational practices, then maybe we need a non-arithmetic logic, or one in which the ways in which we think of sort of the assembly of these practices as manifesting different types of claims which are themselves in contradiction with each other.
I think this is really the limit. Violence is the limit of representational practices. Somehow it signifies the borderline. And I think that the circulation of images, for instance, in the last weeks or so about this boat to Gaza, and the discussion which is now going on is about the representational practices of that violence. If the knife was part of the picture, if it wasn't part, if the blood spot was part, and if the picture was cropped or not cropped. So now violence becomes a subject for representational practices where the inclusions and the exclusions are really debated. And of course, this is taken for truth in some way, but I think that my experience is or my understanding, I wouldn't say experience, I hope not, is that violence and perhaps death are the limits of those possibilities of representational practices. And that's where the largest pressure is put on it in this sort of strategy of looking at the sum of representational practices. It's not a simulacrum, because some of these representational practices are very much part of our realities, like parliamentary representation and who is excluded and who is included. And this is something which is very much a part of the Israeli debate right now of exclusions and exclusions. So I thank you for the question, because it sharpens a point that maybe should be made sharp, and I hope it answers to your question. So let's go to the more comprehensive discussion. Is that okay with you? Yeah? Okay, so the floor is open for...
He's sort of jumping off from General Reinhardt's presentation, and I think it has implications for the other panelists as well. It's a question about democracy, and I wondered whether your exploration of some of the practices of performance challenge in any way the notion of democracy as it comes down to us through the Greek tradition and through the Western tradition. I wonder what your thinking is on that in relation to the question of counterpublics. I'm asking about, yes, both those examples, but also perhaps your use of Chatterjee and, you know, where you're at in relation to notions of democracy in taking account of both of those experiences.
I suppose I'm persuaded that some of the classic formulations of democracy around freedom and equality, for example, the ongoing difficulty of specifying what the balance between freedom and equality is in a quote-unquote democratic state, and the need to rethink those or maybe to see how those terms or those concepts become co-opted in certain ways that that don't further the democratic project. If that seems a little bit too abstract, I suppose one concrete example for me is that freedom becomes an invocation of certain Western democracies in order to shore up their own self-righteousness. I'm thinking of my own country, obviously, but not only, against other countries or civilizations that may have a different articulation around the issue of freedom in that particular case. I hope that's not thoroughly opaque. Well, good, you're shaking your head. I mean, I think, therefore, those concepts don't work anymore by themselves, or they don't work as a rhetoric. I think we look for the phrases or the rhetoric, the speech acts, that make the thing be, in a very performative sense. And I think some of those very basic concepts no longer make the thing be, and therefore need to be reworked. I think the reason I particularly like Chatterjee is because he argues that certain kinds of practices that get improvised by people on the edges of the scaffolding of what's supposed to be democratic, they even sometimes are illegal, are pointing the way for a better, more democratic process or a revisionary process that could change the instantiated forms. I hope that responds to what you were asking. Yeah? Okay. I didn't use the examples, so that's another 20 minutes. I won't do that. But while I have the floor, could I just come back to this question that was asked to Freddie and kind of just do one more round on it, which is that to say that the public sphere is made up of these modalities of representation does not necessarily, I think, mean a additive mathematical model. That is, the network may be complex, but it isn't necessarily the sum of its parts. So that even if one was able to articulate, ideally, all of the strands, all of the modalities, wouldn't necessarily have the whole thing. I don't know whether you think that or not, but it was the thing that I was trying to think like you. That was what I would have said to them. Oh, sorry, I was looking at this other person who had asked me the question. I'm sorry.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I picked out this one word, sum, because it would seem to imply that. But my larger object is that there often seems to be a way in which we might imagine that there is a standpoint from which some putative subject of liberal democracy could imagine get some sort of synoptic view of all of these modalities of representation. and whether or not that's even possible, and I doubt that it is, I wonder what sort of, violence might be too strong a word, but what sort of exclusions that view itself perpetrates, or what purposes it might serve. More a rhetorical question than anything.
Thank you all very much for your presentations. I guess, not being a scholar of Habermas myself, I hope this question doesn't sound naive, but I'm interested in what it means to have a breakdown of a supposedly rational public sphere. Like, if the problem is that there's not enough rationality or if that there's too much. I was thinking of Jose Munoz's presentation this morning about the inability to sort of imagine an empathic law, for example, where empathy and affect become the other, say, of rationality or reason or logic or something like that. And in that case, I mean, we want to find a way of avowing and conjuring that in the public sphere. But then I think, on the other hand, of the sort of like the fact that it seems to me that most elections in the United States, at least, aren't won based on rational kind of evaluation of policy, but on, you know, whether you want to have a beer with somebody, or, you know, whether they have a pickup truck, or, you know, if they go hunting on the weekends. And so it really, I mean, in that sense, affect is actually... could be said, I mean, I guess it depends on your political position, but could be said to be the very thing that's undoing a kind of functioning public sphere. And so I wonder if there's something, I guess maybe I was, you know, that's the general thing, is if you could say a little bit more about what does it mean to have rationality break down, and what do we do when we're faced with the possibility that rationality's other is sort of not... Or how do we bring that in? I guess that's the general question.
The two Habermasian critics here. Straight. No, you first. No, you first. I'll start. I guess I understand that Habermas, that the early. It was actually Freddie's quotation about the disintegration of the public sphere. I think he's in the Habermas, the early Frankfurt School mode of thinking on the dangers of mass public culture at that point. I think it's a critique of what will become the media industries and all the rest of it. And God knows he wasn't wrong about it in many ways. I think the problem is that the ideal, the Habermasian ideal, is kind of in his communicative action theory, is kind of a taking turns explaining, and the explanation is respected and taken seriously, and so therefore you and I are going to get over that problem. Now, it's that seems not really an adequate understanding of how reason, creative reason, might work. I think that that affect is its own, it has a place in reasoning, and reasoning can be a quite other sophisticated associational, intuitive, and emotional process, which at the end of the day still is a certain kind of explanatory procedure, which yes, you may need to respect and here's an old word that some of you will remember from fiction. Rocket, it was a in a science fiction novel that kind of meant get it, basically. So that there's another model for reason and how reason works, it seems to me, that can embrace affect as well. And to set those up as a binary is partly what's wrong with politics today, because they're not a binary, and people make all kinds of claims on the basis of their absolute oppositeness.
I would go to Habermas' own position in 1962, less sort of 17 years after the end of the Second World War, and we sort of compare in time with the fact that already 8 years have passed since 9/11. And that moment of violence interfering and what it leads to, and thinking of Habermas writing in Germany in 1962, and sort of course, being aware of this and thinking maybe optimistically about the future German society, also knowing, and everybody knew, that there were so many former perpetrators in very high government positions. How do you relate to that in a kind of nation-building post-World War II? I think that's crucial for the understanding of the whole rhetorical move of Habermas thinking. And I'm thinking very much of sort of these hijackers in 2002, in September 9, which is, or 11, which is sort of a moment of extreme intrusion into the well-functioning economical system of the United States. I wouldn't say that the crash of the markets is a result of the towers, but they're not unrelated.
Annalisa, do you have something? This isn't specifically to, but Finland. Yeah, it's okay.
Yeah, there was here.
Just on the when you were talking, was it on Esposito? You talked about this gift, Munos, and it's kind of like the gift that is never received, and the gift that keeps on giving and giving and giving. But you wanted to describe that as lack in terms of some kind of dialectic of lack. Why not in terms of productivity or something positive? Why did you want to interpret that in terms of absence or void or that kind of Lacanian approach?
There is a kind of productivity, of course. But the link with officium, for example, and the roof of the moons is something that you have to give back. Something like an obligation. So productivity not as a gift, but as an obligation. So it is something that it doesn't belong to us in this moment, and that we have to give to someone else. So in this case, it's something that we have lost.
Sorry, something, maybe this question was articulated already when I was out of the room, so at least there's some corroboration as a concern. I still don't get the obligation, therefore, loss, or I don't get that. That's okay. A bit of a leap in logic.
Okay. In the Esposito's analysis, munus is something that we once had, and that we don't have anymore. Okay, so we have this kind of obligation, respect to someone else. This is the point in this positive.
I think it would be helpful, maybe in this context, to add that it is also connected to sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
It is also sort of leading up to Girard and to other
the guilt. Yeah.
Yeah. So there is a sort of the lack or the loss also having to do with life.
And with purity. Because
So it's the loss of Munos rather than Munos itself.
Sorry, again?
So it's the loss of this Munos, the loss of it, rather than Munos itself being having an inherent lack to it.
No.
It's our lack of Munos. That's
yeah. The loss of a matter. In the case, for example, of Cainus, how do you say in English, Caino? Cain? Abel and Cain?
Cain.
In the case of Girard and Cain, the point that that is also analyzed in some writings by Esposito, the point is the loss of purity after Cain. So something that the community have to give back. The Christian community, for example.
I would go to Benjamin's essay on violence and his mention in the mythical violence of Niobe as this kind of repeated sacrifice that she has to make in order with through the violence is another example.
So just a quick question. So, and this might be getting too, putting too much focus on Habermas and, you know, the West German context he was writing in the 60s, but it seems to me that in some ways when Habermas came out with his book in 62, he was reflecting on kind of the conditions of his time, particularly in West Germany and Western Europe, and kind of this monopolized media industry in West Germany. And so he was really thinking about that as, you know, he was writing and doing his research, he was thinking about the Springer Corporation, et cetera. But what's interesting is, you know, 10 years later, when he starts reformulating his ideas about the public sphere, he really starts taking into account elements that aren't necessarily rational and how they impact the public sphere, specifically thinking about the student protests of the late 1960s. It says how, you know, things like irrationality, provocation, disobedience, even violence actually had an important effect on liberalizing the public sphere, making it more how, you know, he believes it should be. So I'm wondering what that might do to, you know, this talk about, you know, the public sphere as the domain of rationality, where violence is, you know, maybe the limit of the public sphere, how things that aren't rational, how things that are disruptive, actually might play into shaping the public sphere in the way that, you know, Habermas and others might think as the cornerstone of a democratic society.
My sort of very short answer, and I think then we have to adjourn, would be that aesthetic representational practices is the form of representation which can point at those caesuras or those aporias within public spheres or this whole complex of representations. It's a unique form because of its ontological instability. What kind of thing is this? It's something that is all the time moving. So it can move between different systems, and it can also masquerade as a political report, or it can masquerade as something which is really part of a debate, but it has an aesthetic ground. So this instability makes for very sort of very very flexible movement among or within or between those other fields of representation, which in turn, in different ways, reject or accept, exclude or include this within their own debates or the way that they function. And I think this makes me, I mean, of course I can't deal with all of this, but I will focus on the sort of this flexibility, this instability of the aesthetic forms of representation, which will be able to take up in different ways the other spheres as well. One more, thank you. One more, yes, up there.
Ask you if you could elaborate. You several times mentioned Israel and what's going on and the state of emergency, and I'm wondering if you could elaborate on the idea that these aesthetic practices point at the caesuras within public spheres in relation to Israel. I don't know if that's a fair question, but...
It's a fair question, but it would need another hour. And I sort of pointed at the directions and the I've sort of dealt with this in different contexts, but this time I really wanted to go back to the Greek polis and its crisis, and hopefully being able to return in some way with new thoughts to the Israeli sphere, which is really where I start and where I want to go, but with this detour into the Greek world and to other worlds. Of course, Hamlet is also a play that I've been dealing with a lot. So thank you for all the questions. Thank you for your participation. But most of all, thanks to Janelle and to Annalisa and to me.